Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Joe Stewart Rattray, award-winning top executive, International Security and Risk Management Authority, and Vice President, ISACA. Joe, you have this incredible history of significant global impact in security, risk management, governance, and senior executive leadership. So really, it's a real pleasure, and I really thank you for coming in and sharing your considerable expertise and insights with our audience.
Stephen, thanks very much. That's very flattering, and it's absolutely a pleasure to speak with you.
Now, Joe, I was reading your background, and you have this amazing award that you just won. Can you talk more about that award? And again, congratulations.
Thank you. Yes, in August of this year, I was named as the Australian ICT Professional of the Year. It's an award that's jointly given by the Australian Computer Society, the Australian Information Industry Association, and the Pearcey Foundation. You know, for me, it was a great honour. When I was asked just by a colleague if I minded that they nominated me, I agreed. And quite frankly, I didn't think that I would hear any more. I thought it was just such an honour to be nominated, and that I'd never be chosen. And I sort of had a feeling it would go to somebody who perhaps had a different kind of profile in the marketplace. So you can imagine my absolute surprise when I received a phone call from the committee saying that I had won the award. I was really blown away, so quite something special.
So what was the reaction of your family from receiving this award?
My husband was not surprised. He said, fantastic, you deserve it. You know, quite unlike me, who was just, I literally had my jaw wide open, so very supportive, and I've been very lucky over the years that he has been exceptionally supportive of my efforts. So I'm a very lucky woman in that regard. So yeah, also colleagues were close colleagues were also blown away. You know, I got little notes from them saying, "Look, I've seen you in the paper. This is extraordinary." So yes, wonderful.
Well, when you consider that Australia is really leading the world in many respects, and you receiving essentially the top award in the industry, again, congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, what valuable lessons can you share from ISACA's research initiative on creating a culture of security?
That was a fantastic research, which was really a derivative from the business model for information security that was developed initially as a systemic security model by Marshall School of Business at University of Southern California. And they had sort of become a bit stymied and stuck and needed to bring it out into the light away from academe, and so approached ISACA. And so I became involved as early as 2005-6, I think, with that model. Since that time, ISACA has bought the model and has worked on it and developed it further. And one of the derivative products was creating a culture of security, because it was recognised that in a holistic approach to security, which is really what we need to do to enshrine information security into the daily practice of organisations, is to create a culture of security, which of course is not a short-term aspiration. So I think one of the most important things for me was to recognise that what's often thought to be the security governance position of the organisation, when you actually scratch the surface, it's not. There are subcultures that exist. There are differing norms and practices within organisations, which are often actually how things really get done, and they are invariants from, if you like, the written rule or the position from the top. But if you got me started on this, we could be here for a very long time, I have to tell you. So I guess one of the valuable lessons for me was about, and I'll talk about this a bit later, I think, today when we talk about other stuff, but it's about not judging a book by its cover. You can find the champions of a culture of security in all sorts of places, not just at the top of an organisation. So I think that was one of the most important rules that I learnt. And as I say, don't judge a book by its cover.
So what are the main thrusts around your work on COBIT 5.0 that will be of value to the audience?
Well, COBIT 5 is brand new, and it's taking COBIT, we believe, into the next generation. It's looking at COBIT as not just the framework itself, which of course is the platform that that framework was doing. But it's not just the framework anymore. It will be a strong framework on which a series of lenses can be applied depending on what you do in the IT or information security space. Lenses such as information security, governance, management, service delivery, all of those kind of things can be applied. And so it then applies COVID to that area of practice, if you like. It's been recognised that COVID can be applied to a lot of fields of practice within IT and IS and those disciplines, but each has to be seen as being unique and it has its own set of requirements. So taking that into consideration, the first of the lenses that we're looking to apply or view that will sit over the framework is information security. I sit on the COVID for Security Task Force with a group of security professionals from across the globe, and we're hoping that our lens or our view into COVID via security will be released about middle 2012.
And what are the important takeaways on your work on ISACA's business model for information security?
Back to my love, BMIS. BMIS is a 3D view, if you like. It's holistic in approach. It's not static, but rather dynamic in its nature. You look at the diagram, it looks like a triangle, but it should be seen as a pyramid. It's actually 3D, not 2D. The end result is going to look different from organisation to organisation. It may not be that the model will be in complete equilibrium because the context of the organisation and the environment in which that organisation operates will be extremely important. And that may be about the regulatory environment or the legal environment in which it operates. BMIS gets rid of the silos or the stovepipes in organisations because it takes a cross-functional approach to information security. I fell in love with the model when I first saw it just as a diagram in 2005-06 because I could see how this could be applied to organisations and it could be applied as the overarching model, but that frameworks like COBIT or standards like 27001 or ITIL all work collaboratively and in complement with one another. So I think it's one of my important takeaways from this is that there is something in BMIS for everyone and it really is worth an absolute look at.
Well, definitely an amazing piece of work. Now, can you share your completed goals as the chair of both ISACA's International Leadership Development Committee and its Security Culture Task Force?
The Security Task Force, or Security Culture Task Force, was formed to specifically develop and publish the research on creating a culture of security. It was an extraordinary experience, again, working with a group of information security professionals from around the world who shared the same passion as me. Also working with ISACA's headquarters staff, their director of information security practices and some of their research people and the frameworks committee, etc., was a vital and dynamic part of that experience. For each of us. So we actually completed our task by taking that piece of work, looking at what was from the experiences of this global group of people, putting the academic rigour behind that, and working then with a professional writer so it actually hung together and made perfect sense when it was written. So the completed goal was to publish that document and to also get this piece of work out into the world. And that's still only fairly new. It's been on the market for way less than a year now. So there are people still catching up with it. And I find myself talking about it quite often in conversation with clients and other professionals because they start to tell you about a scenario in an organisation and you immediately say, well, I need to give you a link to creating a culture of security. So it really has real world application and that's was the goal, and therefore I think we've actually made our goal. With the Leadership Development Committee, it was first formed last year in 2010, and it's in place to encourage ISACA members to volunteer at the international level. Part of that process is to examine the volunteer participation process and to enhance that wherever possible. So we want to make volunteering attractive and for the experience to be worthwhile for the individual who's taking the time out and often at great sort of personal cost, leaving family behind sometimes, you know, having to meet in locations away from home for periods of time, that sort of stuff. So it's about making the experience worthwhile from both sides of the fence. So we're also looking to identify high potential future leaders of the association. So once volunteers have made that big plunge into working at international level, volunteering at international level on the boards and committees that we have, we then look to see some of those, not, you know, most people are potential leaders because they're working and operating at that level, but some have the want and the will to move to the top of the organisation, and we want to identify those people and encourage them to do so and put the mechanisms in place to allow them to do that. So it's always a work in progress because it's you know, the environment is forever changing, the wants and needs of volunteers are changing, so we need to keep abreast of times. So whatever we may put in place today will not be static. We will need to continue to review that as time goes on. I actually find it's highly gratifying when I speak about volunteering at events, just to see how many people are interested. It's quite amazing the number that will come up after the event and talk to me about it. And sometimes they just simply hang back from volunteering for their favourite organisation simply because they're not aware of how simple the process is of becoming involved at that level. So that's one of the other things that we're really working hard on. And I would sort of advise other professional bodies to look at doing the same thing. If you want to have an active volunteer body, then the thing to do is to make the process of volunteering simple. OSACA has been working on its strategy and strategic future moving forward with McKinsey's. And when we started that process a couple of years ago, one of the things that McKinsey said to us was that they were absolutely astounded at the strength and commitment of our volunteer group, if you like. I nearly said workforce because they do often do that sort of stuff for us. So that was a great compliment, and it meant that I think it was born off that the Leadership Development Committee was created. So they're sort of some of the goals that we have, but it's an ongoing process.
I guess there'd be a lot of cross-pollination with other societies. For example, you're in Australia and there's the Australian Computer Society. I'm sure there's lots of members of both societies. And do you collaborate with the Australian Computers, or do members of OSACA collaborate?
Oh, absolutely, Stephen. That's one of the things that, you know, in my role as International Vice President, I have ensured, I mean, I've always had for about the last 10 years a strong relationship with the Australian Computer Society, and in fact have developed an elective for one of their credentialing program, so which is actually based on an OSACA curriculum. So yes, it's fair to say that we do have a very strong relationship with the Australian Computer Society. The international president of OSACA was in Australia earlier this year, and that was one of the things that he said, that he really enjoyed the way that we did cooperate and would be very keen to see a closer collaboration. And of course I will continue to work with those people at the Australian Computer Society to ensure that. I actually sit on the South Australian, as of 1 January next year, I sit on the South Australian Branch Executive Committee of the Australian Computer Society. So I definitely have a view into both worlds. And so in my role, I'm hoping to be able to further that.
And I guess that even extends out to the International Federation of Information Processing, or IFIP, which is a UN-founded body and a consultative body still for the United Nations. I know that there was the World Computing Congress, for example, held in Brisbane in 2010, and I'm sure OSACA was involved in that World Computer Congress, which was an IFIP event.
That's right, absolutely. Yes, yeah, so there are at those levels, and I certainly know that our Chief of External Relations at OSACA HQ is reaching out to those organisations to ensure that we do have that reach as well. Because, you know, OSACA's 97,500 members in about 160-plus countries. So it has a global reach, and why not leverage so as you get the absolute benefit in the regions that you serve?
Now, you've got this remarkable career within this nonprofit organization, ISACA, and you have this role as International Vice President of ISACA. What do you hope to contribute as this International Vice President?
Well, as I've said, that one of the important things for me is furthering the connections that I've already fostered within the Australian and the Oceania region, because I represent Oceania, which is Australia, New Zealand, and Papua New Guinea. And you can imagine, just listening to those three countries, each has a specific set of needs. So one of my roles is to work closely with our President's Council, which are the presidents of each of the chapters that we represent. And we have chapters in each state in Australia, and I think there are three in New Zealand and then Papua New Guinea. So to work with those chapter presidents and the chair of the President's Council to ensure that their wants and needs are heard at the highest level. Because, you know, I certainly recognise, as does ISACA, that the way we do business in Australia is not necessarily the way we do business in America or Canada or Korea or Lithuania. You know, it can be very different. So we need to take that into consideration. So one of the things that I do is I've said right from the beginning, which was in June of this year, that I wanted to play a hands-on role within the Oceania region. And so I believe that I can do that at an international level with my involvement in the particular committees and task forces. So I can become a two-way conduit, if you like, bring that information back to the region and then take the regional information forward. The other thing is sometimes too, presidents just need a sounding board because they're not quite sure how to go about approaching something. Well, I'm more than happy to get that phone call or to receive an email. Having been a chapter president for 5 years has really helped me, I believe, to understand some of the issues and the needs of presidents and their executives. And where necessary or where it's appropriate to do so, I reach out to them and act as that conduit. I'm also, as you know, very active in promoting ISACA and forming those relationships, as I've mentioned already, with other professional bodies, including the Australian Computer Society and the Australian Information Security Association.
Now, you did some work with this international working group, B5.38. Can you just briefly describe that?
That was with SIGRE. And SIGRE is an organisation with its focus on large utilities, particularly electricity networks. And what we produced was a technical brochure, or what SIGRE calls a technical brochure, which is actually a very large guide of many, many, many pages on cybersecurity in electricity substations. Very rewarding piece of work, which allowed me to work with a multidisciplinary, multinational group of professionals. You know, it's interesting because people often find themselves in that engineering world, and it used to be very different. The engineering world in electricity entities used to be fairly much cordoned off from the world, and there was a little bit of security by obscurity, I think. Well, of course, that's all changed now that we live in the internet age and we sit on TCP/IP platforms. Then all of a sudden there is, we actually share a platform, a commonality for the first time. And so I think the idea was to bring in some external expertise to give that otherworldly view, if you like. So again, a very exciting piece of work, and I was very lucky to be involved with that.
Now, you're an authority in the utility space, and can you outline some important lessons from your work?
I was a CIO in the utility space, which was exceptional, actually. I was responsible for both real-time, the SCADA-type systems, and for business IT. And, you know, I learned so much from my engineering and telecommunications colleagues during that time that was, you know, I'm still grateful for today. It actually piqued my interest in securing that kind of environment. So it's a little bit of a passion. It's not something that I work in all the time, but it's something that I really enjoy. And I certainly, I guess for me, I've been able to continue some of those relationships since that time, and that's really been fantastic for me. But one of the issues that I think we still face in that world of control systems is there is still a bit of a propensity for that element of security by obscurity belief. But, you know, I think the thing that we're seeing is that atmosphere is no longer as rarefied as it once was. And, you know, Stuxnet was one of those things that, that sort of brought it home for some people. And now that they're beginning to look at, well, yes, that was an enormous and a very orchestrated attack. But if it's happened once, it could continue to happen. So there is certainly a different awakening, I think, now than there was previously. And I think that's a really positive thing, that there is that awakening. And I'm so glad that the utility space is having that wake up.
When you did your work with the utility space then, are you working with government agencies as well in terms of, you know, like, you know, the equivalent like of sort of like the Secret Service or the intelligence agencies within the government? Or?
Interesting question, Stephen. In Australia, utilities are not, well, utilities until about 15 years ago were always government owned. Now we have a combination of some are privately owned and some are still government owned. So that creates a whole raft of issues, as you can imagine, when it comes to things like crisis or emergency management. So the Australian government has recognised that, and they have put in place some safeguards around that, around critical infrastructure protection, if you like. So there's a whole lot of work that goes on in that field. So it's not working with the Secret Service per se, but it's certainly working out of the same portfolio in government that they all sit with. So yes, there is understanding of the critical infrastructure and protection, and I was involved in part of those programs, which was about information sharing in those environments. And the government were offering a kind of a vulnerability assessment, if you like, for critical infrastructure. And we're also then, you know, we will help you to pay for this work if you are happy to share your information, which is obviously anonymised after the event. So I had been involved as a player in that, as one of the providers of those kind of services, which was, as you can imagine, very interesting work, because it's not, in that case, when you're talking about critical infrastructure, you're not just talking about water, electricity and gas. You're also talking about things like the food supply chain, transport chain, blood services. There's a whole range of things that most people don't automatically think of as critical infrastructure. And that's what I found to be really interesting, to see the range of players that I was working with in that sphere.
Joe, you have this background with ISACA, and, you know, ISACA has these threads into governance and IT and technology and security, but you also have many, many years of executive senior leadership and international leadership. So taking all of those different kind of experiences that you have, what would be your top five governance tips?
Yes, it's interesting. To take out five is quite a hard thing to do. But I think for me, the top governance tip, which is a top business tip, I think, is never underestimate the human factor. Because whatever governance you put in place, it has to be workable. It has to be practical in nature as well. Because otherwise people will find a way around not doing it. So always, never underestimate the human factor when you're putting a governance posture in place. I guess number two is to ensure that there are good policies in place that are as unambiguous as possible. Ensure that the policies that have been developed are disseminated out to the appropriate staff and contractors and, you know, temporary staff and third-party service providers, whatever is appropriate to your organisation. Again, it sort of derives from that never underestimate the human factor, because people need to know what their rights, their roles and their responsibilities are in relation to the corporate system, applications and indeed the information and data that they have access to. I guess number three would be information security or IT must be aligned with the overall corporate strategy. You can't have, because, you know, that's a subset of governance, whether it be IT governance or whether it be information security governance. They've got to be aligned with the overall corporate strategy. There's no point in them running off and doing their own thing. There has to be some purpose, some advantage to the organisation for it to achieve its goals. The other thing is, again, we're coming back to some human factors stuff. Information security awareness has got to be an ongoing program and not a one-off event. I see organisations that have a wonderful security, or have a wonderful governance posture in place overall. All they do is an induction program. Well, all that does is catch the new players, the newbies who are coming into the workforce. It doesn't capture the people who've been there for a long time. So you need to make sure that people don't forget, that they are reminded of their rights, roles and responsibilities as well. And sometimes it's also by us, we have a duty of care as employers, so we need to make sure that our staff are aware of how they keep themselves safe online, for instance. And that's in the workplace and at home. So all of that, if we give them a little bit about how they can protect themselves at home, it's actually advantaging us as employers, and potentially giving us champions throughout the organisation as well. The other thing is too, if we're talking about information security governance, it's got to be a commitment from the top. It's the same as we're talking about the enterprise IT governance. So we've got to have commitment from the top of the organisation, the top of the tree. That lovely North American expression, tone at top. You know, we really need to have that. If there is not the right level of commitment, it sends the wrong message to all the troops below. You know, if I'm at the top of the corporate tree and I'm not seen to play by the rules, then I give the, you know, I'm leading by example, and people will think, well, Joe doesn't do it, so why should I have to do it? I shouldn't have to ring Fred at the help desk, or I shouldn't have to log a call to have something done. I'll just go around the corner and tap somebody on the shoulder and get them to do it for me. That's, you know, a fairly trivial example. But we have to make sure that the rules that we have in place are the rules for everyone, and that we don't create false norms as a result. So I guess they're probably my top five tips.
You know, those are great tips. And one thing that I was looking at is that you have all of this credentialing. And can you overview your certifications and the value they bring to your work and your clients?
The certifications that I hold, Stephen, show my clients that I have a strong understanding of the particular, you know, core body of knowledge that relates to each of those credentials. Holding the certifications also shows that I have an ongoing professional development program in place, and just as doctors or lawyers do, that will enhance the credentials and my own practice, which of course then advantages my client. Each of the credentials has that continuing professional education component that must be met each year. Sometimes it's a tough call, but it's something that we have to do. You have to take the time out to keep abreast. So I'm a certified information systems auditor, certified information security manager. I'm certified in the governance of enterprise IT, certified in risk and information systems control, and I'm a certified professional under the Australian Computer Society's certified computer professional program.
A series of remarkable achievements that combine education and continued professional development and adherence to best practices and more. So again, congratulations on that remarkable achievement.
Oh, it's just some hard work. You know, it's about if you want to be the best you can be, sometimes it's about investing your own time and indeed your own capital in that. And I guess that's always been my approach. The credentialing that I have, including my first two degrees, I have never, I've paid for all of it myself, and I've done it in my own time. It's not been employer funded, which is, has been my choice, because I'm doing it for myself. And for me, that's an important thing, and not everybody's the same, but I need to do it for myself to make it real and valid for me.
Jo, you're an international and highly respected luminary for your work, both in your region, but also globally. And I want to mine some of that. So can you profile your extensive history and then three valuable lessons that you wish to share from each of your top three leadership areas?
Yes. I actually started late in my professional development as far as the world that I ended up in. You know, I often see people in, particularly in IT, and they didn't start in IT. You know, they've had two or three other things that they've done first. Well, I'm one of those people. You know, I started off with IT had always been there for me, but I also had a very strong education type background as well. So I ended up by spending time doing in IT education, in fact. So that was quite an interesting time in my life, which I think has actually helped to inform what I do today, because I have my master's degree has a specialisation in psychology, which, quite frankly, in the information security world, that really, really helped. So, you know, I spent time in the academic world where I was working to help academics keep abreast of IT in many ways. So that was quite a challenging thing. I also was looking up, it's always been cross-functional. My work's always been cross-functional. I was also looking at things like different ways of teaching and learning. So that was also quite rewarding. And then I went back into on the tools, you know, with the sleeves rolled up, and I was involved in a number of large ERP implementation programs, and then got into the utility space and started working. My interest was peaked in security in about the early 1990s, I suppose. And so once I was in the utility space, again, security fell to me. And that's when I really began to get a full head of steam, I suppose. So for me to get my full head of steam up, I was in my early 30s. So, you know, it was a later start than for most folk. So, and then, you know, worked my way through the organisation, left as CIO. I went to the utility for 10 weeks to do a project, and I left 7 years later as the CIO. So that was quite remarkable, I thought, and a great experience. Got a tap on the shoulder, was asked to go and work in the consulting world, which I did, and that was has been exceptionally rewarding. I can't tell you how rewarding it's been. I've been working with some extraordinary, extraordinary clients over the years. But if I look at some of those things that I've learned about during those times, I guess one of the most valuable or hardest lessons for me was when I made the move from operational management to strategic management. It was so hard for me to sort of come off the tools, if you like, and delegate the task that I had to do, or that I would normally do, and that I loved doing, and knew that I could do in a heartbeat, to somebody else. It was a huge leap for me from the doing to the directing of the doing. And then all that strategy stuff, you know, of looking towards the future, where I guess I had been very much aware of the future, but very much in the moment and doing what needed to be doing to keep those lights on. And so that was the hardest thing. You know, the lesson learned from that for me was that not to expect everyone to have the same standards or concepts of time and urgency as you do yourself. That was a really hard one, and you sometimes have to recognise that you need to spell it out, because people, not everybody has the same mindset. They're not in the same headspace as you. So sometimes you have to spell out what you need from people. And sometimes it's necessary to delegate, walk away, shut yourself in your office and close your eyes and hope for the best. Let the person that you've delegated to do their job without you breathing down their neck. So that was a really hard lesson for me. When I was appointed as CIO in the electricity entity that we were talking about before, I'd been promoted from inside the organisation, so I knew the people who I was going to be working for and with, and I had been in a senior management role in infrastructure management, so I'd basically been on the business IT side of the world, and all of a sudden I was going to have to work also with a group of predominantly engineers. They would be working for me and with me. These many guys ran the real-time and near-real-time systems, the control systems, the things that kept the electricity flowing through the grid. So incredibly intelligent people and incredibly good at their jobs. I spent some time thinking it through, thinking, how am I going to integrate the ops team with the business IT team? So, you know, I have to say there were a couple of restless nights involved before I decided to take the whole group off-site, provided them with some lunch. It's amazing what lunch and a beer will do. Talked about strategic direction for the group moving forward. Then I actually left them to it. I said, you know, this is your time, and I want you to spend the time networking with one another, get to know one another. And, you know, this was all, I'm flying by the seat of my pants, not knowing whether this is right, wrong or indifferent, or whether the CEO is going to scream at me later. But as it turned out, some of these folks only knew each other, or each other's names, from the phone list. They'd never actually met. So they suddenly recognised that they were, again, they were human beings, that they had wants and needs, and they had professional levels of professionalism on both sides. So it actually broke down the us and them barrier that potentially could have caused some real issues for us. So I guess, again, the lesson learnt there for me was never underestimate the human factor. You know, it can overcome all kinds of issues, but on the other hand, it can sometimes account for a whole heap of others as well. But really, that was just something that it was, as I say, I flew by the seat of my pants doing it, but it turned out for the best. And I've actually taken that and used that many times since then, particularly if I want to integrate two teams together, or I want to get people thinking in a like-minded manner. I guess from the consulting perspective, the great lesson for me has been, I mentioned earlier, never judge a book by its cover. You know, there are organisations that my team and I go into where we think our job is going to be an absolute piece of cake. You know, the organisation has a great reputation in the market. It has all kinds of certification and compliance programs, and there are great policies and guidelines in place. You know, what could we possibly find wrong, or what can we possibly recommend for these guys? Well, in one case in a financial services organisation, we were asked to undertake a security management review. It was a large organisation, and it was like the one, you know, with everything looked to be in place. I found the best information security policy that I think I'd ever seen. We found best practices being used in the information security team. There were information security awareness programs in place, and we were absolutely delighted. We thought, this is just brilliant. However, once we stepped outside the information security offices, we discovered that no one, and I mean no one, was aware of any of this. They hadn't seen a copy of the policy. They had no idea what their rights or responsibilities were under that policy. One or two had said that they'd heard that one was being developed and that there was going to be some training, but that was it. There was nothing else. So second lesson was that from that was that the best policy in the world will prevent absolutely nothing unless it's disseminated and socialised out to the people at the coalface. And the other thing there was too, we can't afford to work in silos. You know, we really should be taking a cross-functional, holistic approach to this. Information security is everybody's business in an organisation. Everybody has some data that they need to look after that they wouldn't want to see on the front page of the newspaper. I guess the other thing that I've learned over the years is that there are champions in organisations who will do your bidding. And they can be anywhere in the organisational structure. One of the things that I've found oftentimes in organisations is people like the executive assistant or the personal assistant are men and women who have access to incredibly sensitive data. They actually are influencers on decision-making processes way beyond their level on the organisational chart. So you should never downplay the importance of those people as champions. And oftentimes if you get them to believe in your gem of an idea, take that seed and run with it, you'll find that you have a rich garden of possibilities that have opened up for you. So I think, Stephen, they're probably the most important lessons that I've learnt over the years. So again, it's about don't expect everyone to have the same standards and concept of time and urgency as yourself. Let people do their jobs without breathing down their necks. Never underestimate the human factor. Never judge a book by its cover. There's a repetitive theme here, I know. And look for the champions. Look for the champions in the oddest of places. You'll be delighted.
Now, that's a remarkable series of tips and lessons from really, you know, doing it. Have you ever considered putting this into a book or a series of tapes or videos or a YouTube or something like that?
No, I haven't actually.
Well, maybe this is a start, right? Because it's now encapsulated in the podcast. And especially, you know, you mentioned specifically the administrative assistants that are out there and the tremendous influence they wield. I mean, I personally have seen that myself. So, and
Exactly. Not to be underestimated.
Yeah, exactly. And you treat everybody with lots of respect, right? So.
Correct.
Now, you have this really interesting career, a great leadership, significant global impact. I just got back from the World CIO Forum, and one of the keynotes was Maria Clavé, and she's on the board of Microsoft and the board of Broadcom, a distinguished scientist. She's the president of one of the top engineering colleges in the U.S. But the focus of her talk was sort of the low penetration in terms of women in technology. But she also spoke about sort of the barriers for that penetration, where she sort of recounted one story where, you know, women could be in a meeting and they could come up with an idea, but basically it's not sort of recognized, whereas somebody else, like a male, comes up with the same idea, it is recognized. And she, you know, she gave some strategies around that. Have you encountered what I would call unconscious bias in sort of your career, and how did you overcome it?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, I'm still meeting it. It's quite extraordinary. Young women often are, in fact, I was only asked recently by a young woman who's, you know, early career development IT professional, and she asked me, is there a glass ceiling? And my response was, it's not a glass ceiling, it's a granite ceiling, and you'd better take your jackhammer with you and be prepared to use it. And that's the reality. Unfortunately, women find themselves having to be better credentialed, better prepared, and indeed more prepared to fight for their beliefs or their right in the boardroom than perhaps their male colleagues. Now, this is not always the case, and it's not the case in all organisations or all walks of life, but I have certainly found it over the years, which is what led me to start with getting those initial credentials after leaving university. So it is difficult, and there is certainly bias. Oftentimes it's unconscious, but it can be ingrained and it can be systemic in organisations where they don't recognise that what they're doing is actually a form of discrimination. So it is a problem. I've worked predominantly in male-dominated environments, so I've had to get used to it over the years. I do feel for women who are potentially isolated in the workplace because they are one of very few women amongst an enormous group of men. And we find that in areas like megatronics and interesting areas like that, that are sort of technology-related industries. Sometimes I've found that it's about putting your idea forward, socialising it before the event. You may even hear your idea come out of somebody else's mouth, but at least it was your idea. That's not ideal, but sometimes it does help. But certainly that idea of socialising it, so it's not something that you slam on the table in a meeting, that can be an issue as well. And as for being ignored, that's just bad manners as much as anything else. So sometimes it's about standing your ground. It's really about knowing when to back away. When is it time to back away from this? Am I prepared to die in a ditch for this? So you do have to ask yourself questions. Otherwise, you can end up by doing nothing but fight all your life, which is not a pleasant place to be. So I do think of things and look at it along the lines of, am I prepared to continue to fight City Hall? How far would I go with this? What is the impact going to be? And is it worth the impact or the consequences of the impact? So lots of questions you have to ask yourself. But for early career professionals, women do have to be prepared that it's not the equal playing field that we would like to think it is in some cases. In other cases, yes, it is.
Do you think in our lifetimes that we're going to see this, or do you think it's going to be 50 years before it is going to be sort of a flat playing field?
Well, the scary thing is, Steve, and I thought I'd seen it, you know, quite frankly, when I was a very small child, you know, there was all the Bernadette Brahe and Gloria Steinem and all those wonderful women and Germaine Greer and people out there really fighting for the rights of women. And it's been enshrined in legislation, absolutely. That's there. So we have won part of the battle. Now it's being accepted in a corporate sense, which has got nothing to do with the legislation. This is about developing new social norms. And if we're talking about creating that kind of culture, here we go back to creating a culture, it is longitudinal. It's not going to be something that will happen overnight. And women have to continue to want to fight. There might be women out there who want to go back to the way it was before. I don't know. Certainly not those women that I meet. I think women just are going to have to be prepared to continue that battle or find places where they don't have to battle.
Joel, throughout your career, you've encountered many opportunities and you've been able to convert those into stellar successes known both in your region but also internationally. But you also must have encountered some challenges. So can you talk about some of those difficult challenges and the lessons you've learned from working with those challenges?
I guess I've just talked about one. But in the actual field of practice that I'm in, this is interesting too. When I first started in information security, which was some time ago now, 16 years ago or something, I remember being at a conference and there were something like 200 or 300 delegates there. And there were less than 6 women there. So I've got to say, that's been an improvement. We now have probably 10% are women. So that's really nice. In some respects, it's been a challenge being seen as a novelty, being, you know, one of few women in the business. But I think we've gotten well beyond that now, which is really good. But I guess when I started in the information security business, the market wasn't particularly well educated about what information security was and about the bad stuff that was out there to hurt organisations. So I spent a lot of time in the early days getting organisations to recognise just exactly this, what the potential impacts to them were with regards to information security. Then a couple of years ago, two, three years ago, we saw a change to an extraordinary extent. Organisations had begun to be somewhat blasé about security, and in some cases they dropped their awareness programs and the like because everyone knew that stuff, so they thought. And they thought the perimeter was pretty safe. I think that's come pretty much full circle now, and we see that with the high-profile breaches that we've seen in the last couple of years, attitudes have again begun to change. So education of our market and of users more generally is an enormous challenge, to the point that we're now even seeing governments getting involved in it. You know, the Australian government released a few months ago a white paper on optimising our digital future, and it was really about cybersecurity. So, and they've begun cybersecurity or cyber smart programs in schools, kids. So we are beginning to see that full circle coming around again. So I think one of the greatest challenges that I've had is actually getting people to understand what information security really is about. One of the things that I was told in the early days was, it's like you're selling air in a bottle. So I think we've moved on from there, which is a good thing. So I guess, again, the lessons to be learned out of that is that I've needed to collect stories and anonymise those stories to be able to help to educate the market, saying, you know, we're interesting as human beings. We always want to think it's going to happen to the other person and not to us. So, you know, it's about saying to CIOs and to CEOs and to boards, you know, this could happen to you because it happened to an organisation in Western Australia, you know, because it's also about not saying that it happened in America or in England or in Germany. It happened on your front doorstep. So that's been one of the challenges and one of the lessons, I suppose, for me in my particular field of practice professionally. You know, we've talked about the personal stuff, about the female stuff, and that's another issue. And I don't like to play that up too much, because I believe that we should all still be counted on our merits.
Joe, how will you accomplish your top 3 goals in your current position, and how will you measure success for each of these goals?
Okay. Well, I constantly set goals for myself which relate to my career and my personal life as well. And then there are those that relate to my position within the firm that I work for. I went to RSM Bird Cameron 3 years ago, and there was no information security practice there. In fact, there was a little bit of external audit support in the IT area, but that was pretty much it. So I began from a greenfields position, and I'm still building the practice, which is continuing to take shape. And it's, you know, it's now really about information security, IT assurance, and governance. So they're the sort of things that we're addressing and looking at. But it really was a greenfield to begin with. So I guess the top goals for me are to build a highly successful practice. Secondly would be to people it with the very best that I can. And thirdly, and possibly the most important, to exceed my clients' expectations. You know, obviously, as far as measures for those things are concerned, obviously profitability is one measurement, as is staff turnover or retention, and cohesiveness of staff is very important. And I guess finally would be is customer satisfaction. You know, we take a no surprises approach to our consulting, and so it's about continually receiving feedback from clients during the engagement as well as after the engagement. It's no good waiting till the end to do a client feedback survey. You need to be finding out as you go along, and if you find something out, you find the big nasty that they really don't want to hear about, you're best off telling them about it as soon as you find it, as opposed to waiting till they get the report and it's on their desk some months later. You know, allow them that same courtesy to give them feedback as well. So I guess that too, again, it's about having a two-way street. I like to have a two-way street opened between my staff and me, between my superiors and me, and my clients and me.
Because of your long history of success, I would say that you're at the epicenter, or you're the keystone of the governance and security and IT-related ecosystem out there, and really in the best position for this next question, and that is, can you describe, one, two, or three areas of controversy or much discussion in your research and work?
Yeah, this is it's an interesting one. I guess, again, you know, we're talking about an epicenter, which is a lovely term. I think culture is at the epicenter of most things that we do. And it's controversial because it's different depending on the region of the world that you're in. So that geolocation is very important. It's going to be, it's going to change depending on the religious environment, the political environment, even climatic environment. All of that is going to make a difference. So there is a great deal of controversy around what is culture and how do we build a culture that is appropriate to our organisation? How do we build the norms in an organisation that create the right culture for our kind of business? Because it's always going to be in the context of a business and the environment in which that business operates. Also, you know, how much is technology and how much is culture in the ITIS type businesses? That's another area of controversy. I have a theory that in information security, it's 80% about the people and 20% about the technology. If you get the people wrong, then it doesn't matter what the technology is you have in place. They will find a way around it. So, you know, you have to make it so as you have to deal with that, take that into consideration. So, to me, that's can be quite controversial, because there are a lot of people who turn that around and say, absolutely not, it's technology first, everything else second. One of the areas of much discussion, of course, currently is, and I almost cringe to say it, cloud. And I was at the Osaka Insights conference in June of this year in Washington DC. I was interviewing a panel of chief information security officers from three large organizations in the United States. And one of the things that they all cringed at was this, the notion of cloud. And I think the issue there is that there's the good and the bad of it, you know, and there's some real positives for some organizations. But you have to look at the fine print. You have to look at the agreement that you have in place with the provider. Where are they located? What's their financial situation like? you know, there are cowboys in every business, including the cloud. You know, there are those organisations that are likely to go belly up. So you need to be aware of all of that. Where is your data being held? What legal jurisdiction is in play? Am I subject to the Patriot Act? And goodness knows what else, depending on where that data might be held. So that's one of those areas of discussion. Of course, ISACA has a white paper out on cloud as well. So, and that's Control Objectives for Cloud, which is quite a helpful document. But that's one of the ones that's really, there's a lot of controversy. A lot of SMEs are racing into it going, this is fantastic. This is going to save me money. Well, even CSC have done a recent survey and yes, they're saying their savings, but I don't think the savings are as big as most people had thought they would be. So there's an issue. The other area of controversy I see or much discussion currently is the use of social media in the corporate environment. And this is a two-pronged thing. You know, it's do we allow our staff to have access to Facebook at work? And do we use this for our own product benefit or our own organisational benefit? And what benefit is there really for us to do that? We also have the good, the bad and the ugly of social media these days. You know, it's fantastic. Facebook's a fantastic way of being able to keep in touch with people, you know. And I've heard some wonderful stories about people getting back in touch after many years of losing contact with relatives and friends, you know. So absolutely sensational. But then there's the other side of it. You know, there's a piece of research by a lady called Eve Dougal from the Australian National University. It's her PhD dissertation, in fact, is about deception online. And there are people who have a propensity to lie online. You know, it's like the old cartoon, no one knows I'm a dog online. Well, this is the same sort of thing that's happening. Some people can't help themselves. So they will reach out and do some of these things that they would never dream of doing in a one-to-one or you know, in-person conversation. So that's a bit of the bad and the ugly, I think, of it. But as I say, there are some positive sides. As for businesses, they really need to make a decision as to, is this something that they want to be involved with? Does it have benefit to the business? How do they then put the governance in place to ensure that only the right information gets out there? Do they also have an acceptable use policy in place that ensures that staff know what they can and cannot say online? That's another really important issue. Is you know, cyber trashing companies and individuals online. It's socially unacceptable behaviour, and we just need to make our organisations and our employees aware that it's not acceptable. So I think they're probably the three top issues of the moment.
Yeah, that's a fascinating sort of discussion of areas of controversial discussion, and I think the market sort of supports all of those areas because there's, you see it in the press and so on. Now, I'm going to ask another question, but it's somewhat related to one of the answers you gave previously, and it's really focused on nonprofit organizations and associations out there. So, like, why should IT professionals and executives join nonprofit organizations or associations?
Okay. I believe that it's a way of enriching your understanding of the industry sector in which you work. It's a sensational way of networking with people. You know, people that you wouldn't normally get a chance to mix with. You know, you are mixing with a college of your peers, oftentimes at the highest level, and if it's on an international basis, well, that is just extraordinary. That really has been an amazing experience for me with ISACA, to now say that I have a family of friends across the world who are like-minded professionals. That's pretty extraordinary. I think the other thing too is that you generally have access to a core body of knowledge as well, you know, like the publications, like the research materials. Then there's also the credentialing, all of that sort of stuff. But I think over and above, it gives you an opportunity to give back to the community, to the industry community that has provided a career and a place for you to go Monday to Friday. You know, quite frankly, it's about giving back to the community that's given you so much in your career.
What specific challenges and opportunities should IT practitioners and businesses embrace today and in 5 years?
You know, the crystal ball's a bit foggy this morning, but you know, 5 years out is these days is quite difficult. I think it used to be much easier some years ago. You know, we talk 3 to 5 years without even thinking about it, but 5 years now is a long time. Just think back over the last 5 years and see what we've seen happen over those last 5 years. But from my discussions with CIOs both in Australia and in the US, they all seem to have concerns about the consumerisation of IT. And with that, we're talking, of course, about cloud and legal jurisdiction issues around where data resides, and particularly as we move towards this world of big data, you know, where there's more and more data being processed and have access to. The other issue, of course, is the notion of BYOD, bring your own device. All of these insecure devices on a network. How do you actually handle that? How do you handle the fact that, yes, I want everybody to bring their own device and they're going to pay for them, but oh my God, one's been stolen or broken or something. How do you deal with that? Do you have to have hot spares? All the practical stuff that goes with it as well. So I think there's some of the things that are creating issues at the moment. The other thing is security on the inside, not just the perimeter. I was talking to a colleague of mine last night, and one of the things that they're beginning to see is attacks on databases. So, you know, they've gotten through the perimeter, now they're actually attacking the databases, getting the information that they need directly from a database. So we need to start looking at database security for one, but internal security inside the network. You know, I think we're going to see this thing about protecting the perimeter is getting a little bit more foggy all the time. So it's almost like we're taking a position of retreat. Yes, we can do what we can at the perimeter, but if they happen to breach the perimeter, how can we protect what's on the inside? I think that's going to be very important. It's not just about locking the outside door. It's now about locking the internal doors as well. And I think, you know, I think we're going to see some changes there. The other thing is too, you know, we do live in an outsourced, offshored, cloud-provided world. And we need to make sure we know who has access to our data legally through those means. You know, and so here we're talking about the controls around privileged users. How many people are privileged users? I remember some years ago hearing the story of a particular very large outsourcing organisation that they used the same credentials every day. Shift on, shift off. You would just pass the credentials on to the next person. And, you know, everybody knew that the password was Sputnik 8 or Altera 7 or Red Dwarf 1, you know, or Enterprise or whatever. They were all sort of sci-fi type related credentials. So, or passwords. So these are the things that, you know, you want to have some level of comfort around. And if we're going to go further and further into this somebody else doing it for us kind of world, then we need to make sure we have the controls in place, and that those controls are enshrined in the agreements that we have with those providers. We can't leave it to the providers. It's about us, because ultimately it comes back to us. It's our data, and so we are ultimately responsible for it. So that's sort of as far as my crystal ball's looking at the moment. But I think these are all issues that we're going to see increased focus on as time goes by.
I'm going to add an extension to the question. It's a little bit of has a science fiction tinge to it or theme, and that is, you know, there's this very famous inventor, Kurzweil, and he talks about this sort of singularity happening in you know, in the next 20, 25 years, something like that. But let's say the next 50 years. Do you think that's going to happen? And the concept of a singularity is, you know, where you have computers and humans merging together and they sort of become inseparable, and it won't be possible to predict anything anymore because change will be so fast, and you may be able to download the consciousness of a human being into a computer. And do you think that's going to happen?
Good Lord, I hope not. However, watch a child with its Nintendo DS. You watch a kid with their Nintendo DS, and I saw it recently at a Christmas party. Some friends' kids all had their DSs. They were talking to one another. They were playing games on their DSs together. They were connecting via this little piece of plastic and gizmos, you know. So it is there to a degree. Absolutely, there is that. You know, we see it with our younger career aspirants in the workplace, that they are sitting right next door to their colleague, but they send them an email or they text them. So what concerns me, rather than us melding and becoming a computer, is that we lose the art of one-on-one interplay, that the human-on-human interplay disappears. You know, more and more it's being done through another interface. So, you know, we rely on the interfaces so much more. So that's the thing that concerns me most. But I certainly hope that we, you know, and for that, because there's always that issue when we talk about downloading the conscious into a computer system. That's great, that's the conscious. But where does the moral and ethical stuff come into it? We haven't yet built the computer that can deal with that stuff. So that would concern me. But I certainly see that we are more and more we are reliant upon an interface. You know, it's becoming just part of the way people do stuff. You know, I like to get up and go and talk to people in the office about stuff, but I know that my younger folk in the office are not going to do that. That's not going to be a two-way street. They're going to do it through email.
So from a personal standpoint, do you have a smartphone and do you text and do FaceTime and all those other things, or...
Sure, of course I do. I've got, you know, I actually have a smartphone and a BlackBerry, yeah, of course I do. And I spend a lot of time in airports, and so that's often a good time to be able to do some, you know, Facebooking and messing about with friends and people, you know, or just texting backwards and forwards. You know, I'm in the Qantas Club having a drink, and I'm having a, you know, Coca-Cola for you too. That sort of stuff. So, absolutely. But the reality is I like the one-on-one stuff as well. I like to be able to choose, you know, I like to be able to have a conversation with you, Stephen, or have one via an electronic means, you know. No, yeah, either or. I guess I'm lucky. I'm in that generation that I can do both.
Or one of the tips you gave before was about this human factor, right, and face-to-face, and it makes a difference, so...
Oh, it does, absolutely. And I must admit, that's one of the things I do talk to my team about is, you know, I find myself saying, just pick up the phone and talk to the person. Don't, you know, you're worrying yourself about something unnecessary. Pick up the phone and talk to them, because oftentimes you'll get the wrong impression in an email.
That's definitely true, right? Email just doesn't communicate the nuances that a sensitive discussion can have face-to-face.
Correct.
Now, on this next question, it sort of ties in with some of the work that ISACA does, but it's sort of more global and perspective, and that is, what are your thoughts on computing as a recognized profession, like, let's say, accounting, medicine, law, engineering, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to code of ethics, and recognized credential?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think that we're all really beginning to see that. You know, we have, ISACA has its code of ethics, a set of globally recognized credentials that spans the constituency group who are professionals. It is the demonstrated professional development program that's in place. So we're seeing that, you know, and the Australian Computer Society has something similar, and there are other organisations out there that I'm aware of that also have this similar way. So I actually do think we're seeing it. Other professional bodies certainly have similar, you know, and it goes back to what I was saying before about a college of peers and a body of knowledge and those recognised credentials. I think we are seeing that more with a lot of organisations. There had been discussion at one point about sitting over all exams, you know, that would make you an information security specialist in Australia or in somewhere or other else, like a bar exam type thing. And as you know, in some parts of North America, that's a state-by-state exercise. So I'm not sure that that sort of thing would fly. The other thing that we have too is we have a lot of people still in the workforce who learnt at the knee of someone else before we had ready access to IT degrees and other courses of study. You know, IT was something that was part of a science degree, you know, or something like that. It wasn't a standalone degree. So, you know, we still have a lot of people like that that are professionals that we need to recognise. So I think we have to be careful about that as well. And still leave room for those people. One of the interesting things we're seeing in Australia is that a number of universities are offering less straight IT degrees because IT has become so integrated into most businesses, and I think that's kind of part of the reason, and there's less verve for students to go and study straight IT. I remember a discussion about 18 or so years ago when I was working at Sydney Institute of Technology, which was around whether IT should cease to be offered as a standalone course or rather be integrated into all course offerings. And that's almost like we're doing another circle again. So I don't know where that's going to go with the education. I know that the Australian Computer Society offers a credentialing program, the Computer Professional Education Program, which captures a wide range of IT professionals, some with and some without first degrees in IT. But I think that regardless of what you do and how you do it, professionalism is about the people themselves and the values that they hold as professionals.
That's very well put. And now we're sort of down to our last two questions, and this one's going to sort of tap into this status that you have. You're very unique out of 7 billion people on the planet. You're an elite individual. You have an amazing history and a number of domains. So you must have come across really interesting things or stories to share, maybe something amusing or surprising or unexpected.
Yes. Well, I mean, traveling is always an interesting thing, you know. I'm often amazed by the people that you meet in airport lounges or on aircraft, or in fact the travel stories themselves are quite amazing at times. You know, I recently, in fact it was going to Washington DC in June. This was a really big deal for me. I was going to be sworn in as International Vice President of OSACA. I was presenting, at the Congress, the World Congress, the OSACA World Congress, and there was also, a COVID security task force meeting. So, you know, this was a big deal. There was a lot of stuff going on. Well, who would have thought that I would get stuck in Australia for an extra 3 days because of a volcanic ash cloud coming from South America? You know, that was something else. Each day I had no clue whether I was going to get out of the country or not. So finally I did, with great delight, got out of the country. Got to Los Angeles and got told that we'd missed not one, but 3 connecting flights. So this was almost like the trip that wasn't meant to be, because we'd had aircraft problems all along the way as well. So we finally got there. We'd missed 3 flights. And so I'm standing in the queue waiting to sort out what's going to happen next. Very helpful fellow at Qantas. Very helpful man. Not a problem, madam. You know, we can get you on this particular flight with American Airlines. Great. Okay, terrific. Then they're looking for the American rep. They'd gone to lunch. Couldn't find them. So I had to haul myself to the next terminal to actually speak to somebody, and I was just stunned that somebody just disappeared and went to lunch. So this is a bit of a customer service story, I suppose. And so I was just amazed. And when I got to the other terminal, there was a queue of very cross-looking people, all Australians, obviously all being in the same boat as me. And so instead of being cross, we all started to talk to one another. And, you know, some of those people were quite extraordinary experiences, some of the things that they were doing, the reason that they were there. I found there was one guy that I'm standing next to actually is the best friend of my neighbour. And I live in a little country town in Australia. So how is that? I mean, to me, that was quite an extraordinary experience to find somebody who knows the person who virtually lives next door to me in a country town that we're 12,000 miles away from. So sometimes out of the worst experiences, the best things come. Because that just ended up being the nightmare flight. You know, we ended up being delayed another 6 hours it was 11 hours in Los Angeles, and I ended up by having to go and stay at the Marriott for a while. Then I ended up by on a midnight flight to Washington. When I got to the hotel, they'd mucked up the booking. So it just went on and on and on. And it's about being resilient as a business traveller, I guess. And I guess that's the thing. You just need to be resilient when you're travelling and you're travelling for business. And the other thing, I guess the other thing that's really important is to make sure that you allow yourself enough time. I've now learnt my lessons many times with aircrafts and all that sort of stuff, that the mechanical stuff you need to take into consideration as well. These things do break down, and sometimes you have to make sure that you have extra time available to you. So if I have a meeting that's going to start in Washington on the 2nd, I will not arrive on the 1st, but I would arrive on the 31st to make sure that I actually am there in time and that I'm recovered enough to do the job that I need to. So, you know, lots of things like that happen that I think are an eye-opener to us. But, you know, you can meet the most amazing, amazing people. You just have to open yourself to the experiences oftentimes. There are plenty of IT professionals out there spinning the globe just as I am, and I really enjoy meeting them and finding out. And sometimes the best business connections are made that way. And as I said before about the OSACA family of friends that I now have, That's actually a benefit, and I guess I didn't mention it before, but that's one of the real benefits about being involved in some of these non-profit professional associations, is that you do develop extraordinary friendships and relationships. And in fact, somebody said to me recently, I have friends that I have made that I will have for the rest of my life. And that's pretty unexpected and I think quite surprising.
Yeah, that's a substantial benefit of joining these associations that have really significant impact worldwide in standards and certifications, accreditations, and all the value they're generating in terms of bodies of knowledge and best practices and so on. So
exactly.
And in your story, I guess, they talk about 6 degrees of separation, but it sounds like it's like 2 degrees of separation. So.
Oh, yes, I thought that was actually quite outrageous. And, you know, it's not the first time that sort of stuff's happened to me, where you meet somebody in exactly that kind of situation, and you start talking to them, and there's some connection. It might be that they're in information security or they're, you know, something like that. It's just extraordinary.
Now, Joe, we're down to our last question, and I actually turned the tables here, and that is, if you were conducting the interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Well, I think it's really, this is a really hard one, Stephen, and I must admit, I haven't had a lot of time to think about this one. I would probably ask the person what, if they had to pick out one event, that what was the turning point for them in their career that either made them go up or down? What was the one turning point in their career? And if I were to have to answer that question, I would say making the unlikely physical move from Sydney, now everybody knows Sydney, beautiful city, lived there for quite some years, to Adelaide. And we came to Adelaide, which is a city of just 1.5 million people, in southern Australia, and it's in the state of South Australia, it produces 1/5 of the world's red wine, so it's not all bad. But that was a highly unlikely move that would have changed careers. Most people thought that when I said I was doing that, that was going to be a winding back of my career. That I was kind of saying that I didn't have huge career aspirations. Well, that's not me. I do have, I've always had aspirations as to what I'd like to do. So I guess what it did for me was it set a new challenge. So I just had to make the challenge and then try and come to the fore with that challenge. So that would be one question that I would ask. And I think I would ask a similar question to one that you asked earlier, which was about the crystal ball. Take out your crystal ball and tell me what you think is going to happen. I think I've answered that, and I think that it's going to be an interesting and exciting period of our development in the IT world in the next 5 to 10 years. You know, ISACA is looking at its strategy 10 years out, which is quite misty, but I think that's where we're moving now in business. We have to look further out. We can't just look up close and personal, but it does get very much more difficult when you're trying to set strategies that far out into the future. And the third one would be, I don't know. I seriously do not know what a third question would be. That's a bit sad, isn't it? I must have talked myself out.
You know, you mentioned ISACA, and earlier you indicated that it's close to 100,000 now in membership, and you're in over 160 countries. Do you know what the certification rate is amongst your membership? Is it like 50%, 60%, 70%, 80%?
That's a very interesting question, and I should know the answer off the top of my head, but unfortunately I don't. The interesting thing that we are seeing is that with the latest credential, the C-Risk, we're actually seeing that there is a take-up from constituents who have never held another credential from ISACA, and in some cases from anywhere else previously. So that was a very interesting move, I think it's saying something to us that there are obviously people in that area that they didn't feel they fitted elsewhere. We have a lot of our members are multiple, hold multiple credentials. So again, a little hard when you say there are 40,000 sizes, for instance, it's a little bit difficult to say how many of those, you then have to consider how many of those are multi-credentials. So we have a large number of our constituents are multi-credentialed as well. So SISA is the oldest of the four credentials. It has a 40-year history. So yes, and we are talking in the big numbers when we talk about SISA certificate of people out in the world. CISM came next, followed by CGIAT, and then followed by CRISC only last year. So it's early days, but it was quite extraordinary to see the uptake of people through the grandfathering program, which was essentially recognising prior learning and experience as part of their credentialing process.
Jo, I really enjoyed this time talking with you and sharing and collaborating, and I really appreciate the fact that you would come in, considering your very demanding schedule, to share many of your experiences with the audience. So thank you again for being able to contribute your substantial wisdom through and your many experiences in this podcast.
Stephen, it's been a great privilege, and I was flattered when you asked whether I would be interested. And it's been, again, you see, I'm in the lucky position of having met somebody else through a professional society arrangement that like yourself. So for me, this has only been a positive.
Well, again, thank you, Joe, and I just want to conclude then. And I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Joe Stewart Rattray, award-winning top executive, International Security and Risk Management Authority, and Vice President, ISACA.